Welcome to the PEPN podcast on major themes in physical education research. This is episode 94 and explores chapter 7 of Daniel Memmott's book, Teaching Tactical Creativity in Sport, Research and Practice. This week I'm delighted to welcome Sue Wattman as the practitioner responder, but the voice you hear will be mine. I thank Sue for her considered words and for taking the time to respond. Teaching Tactical Creativity. The six D's of tactical creativity: deliberate play, deliberate practice, deliberate motivation, deliberate coaching, diversification, and one-dimension games are easy to say, but not so easy to do. Memmott sets out to demonstrate how teachers and coaches can foster tactical creativity in different basic tactical forms. He does this by providing three series of six lessons that look at the following common aspects of invasion games: identification of gaps, taking the ball near the goal, and supporting and orientating. He introduces these three tactical problems by stating that player rotation, i.e. that positions and team players slash opponents are systematically varied, and diversification, i.e. using different motor skills, are the two fundamental aspects of everything that follows. Player rotation seems obvious, but the elements of diversification, Memmott suggests, don't. In advocating for the use of different motor skills, he sets up each of the six lessons stroke weeks of practice around the following motor skills: 1. Hands only. 2. Feet only. 3. Bigger ball. 4. Weak hand. 5. Weak foot. And 6. Smaller ball. Memmott also hints that deliberate coaching, i.e. only the rules are provided rather than tactical feedback or tactical instruction, and deliberate motivation, i.e. only instructions that positively bolster players, are aspects of the 6 D's of TCA that might be used in the one-dimension games and the game test situation he introduces. Identification of gaps. In this set of six lessons, Memmott invokes the tactical behaviour of identifying gaps. He sets up a grid, say 10 metres by 10 metres, and places three defenders on a central 5-metre line. He also sets up a maximum height that a pass can travel by stringing a rope across the central line just above the defenders' heads to signify the upper boundary of the pitch. With two attackers on each side of the central line, he asks them to play the ball past the defenders and below the upper boundary using the six diversification elements listed above. In considering ways of developing this idea, I wonder if a wider space could be employed and players asked to run the ball through the gap, either with a ball in hand or dribbling, without being tackled. Or a smaller gap, and maybe with soft tennis balls and smaller rackets, players could be asked to play passing shots. Taking the ball near the goal. Setting up a 15-metre long and a 10-metre wide pitch with two defenders on the central line, Memmott introduces this task to challenge players, four of them stood on the line furthest from the goal, to play the ball past the defenders without losing possession. The six diversification elements are the same, but the challenge is about movement off the ball as well as using the ball, e.g. weight, direction, unexpectedness, creatively. In thinking of developing the games, I wondered what would happen if you rotated the pitch and asked the players to find width instead of depth and used a dribble or a run with the ball in hand rather than a pass. Supporting and orientating. Another game that focuses on ball retention and off-the-ball movement. Working in a 10-metre by 10-metre square, three attacking players are asked to pass the ball to each other as many times as they can, while three defending players try and gain possession. Again, in looking at ways of developing the game, I wondered if it needed to be in a game that valued depth, but which instead valued width. What if the aim was to keep possession rather than progressing up the pitch? This is a tactic often used in rugby sevens as teams wait for a chance to exploit space, and they often give up ground rather than commit to the tackle. Equally, it happens in other invasion games when teams are looking to run down the clock. Regardless of the usefulness of the above games, and maybe my adaptations, I felt, particularly this week, that at the heart of this book was a good theory that is still a little way from being practically useful. The very fact that Memmott, for whatever reason, chose not to bring TCA to the real world only reinforces this for me. I am left to acknowledge the real potential of the model and yet ponder at its true applicability, and I'm wondering if you, the reader, can help me to understand how to apply this model in coaching or school situations. Practitioner Response by Sue Wattman. Measuring impact of new teaching and learning approaches is of growing concern for teachers and coaches, whether they be in the classroom, gym, oval or sports field. What this impacts is, what it is that coaches and teachers claim to have achieved with their students, is a slippery concept. If we are to consider evidence of learning from the example suggested by Mehmet, Invasion Games, I want to look at the second lesson, taking the ball near the goal, and to use Dennis Slade's explanation of his players' uptake of a constraints-based learning approach with hockey. Dennis has written two articles for the Australian Council for Health, Physical Education and Recreations, a teacher sport and recreational practitioner magazine, on his trials and successes with constraints-based tasks and games. And it gives rise to talk further about how you teach tactical creativity and how do you know it worked. In Mehmet's example, as explained by Ash here in the blog, teaching the 4v2 should develop a second capacity of taking the ball near the goal. This is essentially teaching attackers to work in a connected series of 2v1 to eliminate defenders as they encounter them, but more importantly, to deliberately separate defenders so that 2v1 works effectively. The point of the mini-game or constrained task should not only encourage players to work this out, but to understand why. This is where Mehmet's examples need something further, like explaining the nature and role of key questioning. But there is another level that relates more specifically to teaching tactical creativity. With 4v2, if attackers know they are supposed to take out defenders one by one to make 2v1 work effectively, then defenders know that they shouldn't allow that to happen. And after many years of completing this task myself, as an attacker and defender, and as a coach teaching developmental players to do it, I know that defenders win this little game more than attackers do. The 2v1 falls down. This is where tactical creativity tips the balance of favour back towards the attackers. An attacker needs to show the ball, to seduce the defender to break formation and take them on, with confidence, real or imaginary, that they will successfully tackle them without being eliminated. The flare or subterfuge with which the attacker achieves this could be considered an example of tactical creativity. But how do you turn it into a teaching and learning moment for not only other attackers, but also the defenders? In the moment, when the attacker succeeds in forcing the defender to make a decision that leads to their elimination in a successful 2v1, the coach could ask the attacker, "What did you do to convince X to tackle you? Why did you think they would fall for it?" A coach should then ask the defender, "What made you think you would not be eliminated? What did Y do that made you think you would successfully execute the tackle? Why do you think you were unsuccessful?" The attacker may have deployed one of several of a range of highly effective options, a dummy feint, a dramatic increase in pace, and/or a fake call, all of which other players can do and could call upon. But why did they choose that one at that time? This is where the learning moment will occur. Dennis Slade argued that after developing and teaching two mini-games, advantage and parking, he then noted the performance of his under-21 players at a national tournament. Parking, for example, has similarities to the second lesson to create options to get the ball near the goal, focusing particularly on striker positioning. He noted that over the life of the tournament, 5 of the 8 field goals scored by the team were from the parking position, suggesting that firstly, free-scoring attacking play was a feature of this team's performance, and secondly, that some transfer from the mini-game had occurred, therefore some evidence of learning. Furthermore, he noted that the names of the games themselves became cue words to promote positioning, reminding them to be creative. Thus, what and how you talk about in, during, on or upon reflection of a constrained game or series of 6 lessons is going to be just as important to provide tactical creativity as performing the task itself. Acknowledgements. I would like to thank Sue for her contribution and for taking the time to reflect on this blog. Dr. Sue Wattman is a senior lecturer teaching undergrad, HPE teachers and leadership and pedagogy in the Masters of Sports Coaching at Griffith University, Australia. She's played hockey on and off for about 38 years. I would also like to thank Vicky Goodyear for her work behind the scene as copy editor. Her help certainly forms a vital part of the production of this podcast and in getting it out on time in an semblance of coherence. However, it is important to note that any mistakes that remain are mine. This is an audio version of the Peppern blog that can be found at www.peprn.com. Thank you.